Welcome to Middle Grade Mavens, where two author mums discuss their favourite middle grade books, provide recommendations, and share insider industry tips for authors trying their hand at middle grade. Julie Ann Grasso is the author of the Frankie DuPont mystery series, cupcake enthusiast and part-time library book wrangler. Pamela Ukerman is a writer, dancer, and homeschooling mum who sometimes finds time for sleep. Both Julie and Pamela devour middle grade books, not only for research, but to share with their combined brood of four munchkins.
Catherine Doyle grew up in the west of Ireland. She holds a BA in psychology and an MA in publishing. She is the author of the YA Blood for Blood trilogy. The Stormkeeper's Island was her debut middle grade novel and is both award-winning and best-selling. The Stormkeeper's Battle is the final book in the trilogy, and Catherine is here to talk to me today. Welcome to the podcast, Catherine. It's really great to have you here.
Oh, thank you for having me.
My pleasure. And all the way from Ireland, which was great to tee up there and with lockdowns and everything. So extra special. So the Stormkeeper's Battle is the last book of the Stormkeeper trilogy set on the Irish island of Arranmore. Can you tell us how this trilogy came about, where it all began?
Yeah, sure. So must be about 5 years ago now. I was kind of between writing projects and I didn't really know what I wanted to write about next. And I had just finished a YA trilogy. So I kind of had never really written middle grade before. And it was a bit of a loose end. So around this time, my second cousin, Caroline, invited me up to the real island of Arranmore, which is off the northwest coast of Ireland, to see if I wanted to kind of teach creative writing in the local school for a week and sort of give a course to the teenagers there. And I was interested kind of for two reasons. First, you know, I was like, yeah, I need the money. Secondly, that's the island where both my grandparents were born, you know, nearly 100 years ago now, where they kind of grew up and fell in love and made their lives together before moving to America and then back to the west of Ireland where I'm from. So I was really interested in that from, I guess, like a personal historical perspective. Mm. So I went up to Arranmore. It's about like a 5 or 6 hour drive, and then you take a ferry for about 30 minutes. And I was on the ferry on the way over when this kind of island bubbled up out of the sea, that I got this really, I guess I describe it as the closest sense of magic that I've ever experienced. This idea, I guess, this like incredible wildness and rugged beauty and sense of belonging came over me. And I kind of stepped off that ferry and I had a sense of that I was coming home in a way, which was really unusual. And so for the following week, I sort of spent my time tea hopping, you know, from house to house, cousin to cousin, people I've never met before, learning the stories of my ancestors and my grandparents about when they were children and when they were growing up. And I realized, you know, I come from this long line of sort of seafarers and lifeboat rescuers. And my own grandfather was a sea captain, you know, for 60 years of his life. But I never thought much about it. And suddenly I was hearing all these incredible stories of bravery and adventure. And two things about that struck me. One, you know, is that I became really proud and interested in my ancestors and where I came from. And two, you know, this island of Arranmore, it's really small, only about 400 people living there, but they hold their stories and their people long after they're gone. You know, I'd have a cousin telling me about my great, 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 great grandmother as if she was still alive and in the kitchen about to come in and say hello. You know, it was incredible, the sense of memory that lingers there. And back home in Galway, where I'm from at that time, my grandfather was in the early stages of memory loss. And he was losing kind of bits and pieces of himself. And I had the sense that I was losing him. And that was kind of upsetting. But at the same time, suddenly I'm on this island that remembers every single thing about him from when he was a boy to when he left, you know, as a young man. And that became the most precious sort of gift, like another kind of magic all on its own. And I thought, there's something here, you know, that could be written about. And once I started thinking about making kind of Arranmore the setting for a book, Fionn popped into my head, this 11-year-old boy, and then his grandfather Malachy came next, and I thought, oh, I would love to write about a connection between a grandparent and a grandchild around the idea of memory and a kind of a magical island that always remembers you, even long after you're gone. And once I had that kernel of an idea, I came home And I wrote like 10,000 words in a week. It just poured out of me in a way that nothing has ever poured out of me before, and nothing will probably ever pour out of me, you know, again. And I knew it was special. I just felt it. And you know, when it sold, then a few months later, you know, I got the confirmation that it was a, you know, it was going to be a book, which was really exciting.
Wow. I love that. So I'm originally from Cornwall in England. Cool. And it's a similar sort of thing with my family. They just, you know, one side of my family's just been there for generation after generation, and they've got photos and stories, and I go back and I just feel like, yeah, this is kind of where my heart is.
Yeah, Cornwall's beautiful as well.
Yeah, well, Ireland is. I love that you wrote a story around this. And not only did you write a story around Aranmore, you wrote it around Celtic mythology. So how did you weave in the mythology, and how faithful were you to these myth stories in the Stormkeeper story?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question. So I suppose once I had the setting and the internal, I guess, sort of relationships, I realized I wanted, you know, if this island is magical, there needed to be a reason, and there needed to be sort of a framework for that. And for the framework, I looked to Irish and Celtic mythology, you know, because growing up, that's the kind of stuff that I would read. That was the kind of bedtime stories that my dad and my mom would read to me when I was a child. So it was a very natural sort of touchstone for me to go there. And what I did was I just mined Celtic mythology for what I felt like would work in my story. So the baddie or the villain Morrigan, you know, incredibly famous, you know, in Irish mythology, this sort of nebulous dark raven queen. And I thought, oh, she would be really cool. Like, I'll bury her under the island and make it so she's just waking up when Fionn arrives. And then I needed to give her like her enemy. So I chose Dagda, who's in our Irish mythology, the father of all the gods. So I was like, I'll use Dagda as sort of the force for good. And from there, I sort of made this ancient history between them and this ancient battle that took place, you know, thousands of years ago. And now it's all kind of bubbling to the surface again. So that stuff was faithful in terms of that framework. And then when it came to putting other things in the story, like Meros, which is like, they're kind of like mermaids, but gross and terrifying. That's all stuff from Irish mythology. But there are other touches that I added that were more my own. Like, for example, there's a whispering tree on the island. It's like an ancient oak tree that's hidden in a secret layer. And if you find your way to it, it'll whisper to you of the future. It'll tell you like a prophecy or whatever. And so that one I just made up because I thought it sounded cool. But yeah, so I'd say it was a mix of about 50-50, 50% very faithful and 50% offshoots of what I knew of Irish mythology and what I felt like I could make up on my own that would fit with that vibe, if that makes sense.
Yeah, yeah. And in terms of the research that you did, how far did you go with that research? Like, where did you go? Did you go places in person, or was it just kind of all online?
So for like island research and family research and all that stuff, I like scoured the island. I went absolutely everywhere. I chose real places on the island to repurpose for the book. And so I had a really, really strong sense of place, and everything kind of that's in the book, I think, feels real because it is really real to me.
Yeah.
For mythology, a lot of it, books and articles on the internet, and sort of the kind of main fairy tales from my youth, like when I was growing up, those were the three things I kind of scoured to figure out like how I was going to build my Irish history around this island, and how I was going to bury it to make it believable that, you know, no one in the modern world knew about it until Fionn discovered it. You know, that was obviously also really important. So yeah, it was a lot of, I think, predominantly for the Irish mythology, like internet research and fairy tale research, just my favorite kind of research. And then the other stuff was a lot of just actual exploring, getting out and about.
Yeah, lovely. It's just so fun. And so against this ancient mythology, you've juxtaposed the character of Fionn Boyle, who is a regular teenager who plays Mario Kart and fights with his sister. And yeah. How important was it to you to bring in this mythology alongside relatable modern characters and then, you know, a good dose of humor?
Yeah, so I for myself, my favorite types of books are middle grade that are set in the current modern world. I just gravitate more to those kind of characters. I think they have more, I have more in common with them. And I felt the same way about this. I thought there's no reason why it needs to be a historical novel. Mm-hmm. The thing about Ireland and living in Ireland is that this sense of myth and magic is kind of ever present. So the idea that it would be present in the kind of the modern world was a very easy one to get my head around, because there is, I always feel there's a sort of a sense of magic here anyway with the weather, like if you're by the sea. So that was a natural decision for me to make. I wanted to be in the real world. I wanted to be relatable to children and to adults who read it. And so that was one of the first decisions I made. And then it was just about bringing in things that I guess 11-year-old would care about. And, you know, so what you have, he has to fight an ancient evil sorceress to regain control of his island. And he also wants to beat his best friends in Mario Kart. How do you balance these two desires? And I think the important thing is that, like, all this big world stuff is going on, but he still has to be who he is. And that's like, he's a kid and his friends are kids, and part of being a kid, if you have an older sibling, is you can snipe with them a lot, especially when one of them is a little bit older in the teenage years. And I base that very much on my own experience with my two brothers, Colm and Connor, you know, what we were like when we were 11 and 12 and what we're like now, which is like incredibly loyal and we do anything for each other. And that journey with Fionn and Tara was important to me, to start them off as being bickering and annoyed at each other. Like, I can't believe I'm stuck with you all summer. Oh, this is going to be the worst summer ever. And then to kind of evolve their relationship to a point where when all the chips are down and danger is lurking in every shadow, you know, they're going to be each other's strongest ally. And that second thing I think was important for me, to ground Fionn's story in something that felt true and authentic, which is that like push and pull with your sibling. And regarding humor, I just love humor. Like everything I write, there's always humor in it. I think over here in Ireland, we have this tradition of, even in the really sad, desperately sad times, there's always a lot of kind of humor that goes with even like funerals, you know, over here. It's about finding the light in the dark, really. And that's just like a natural thing that comes out of me. And I love books that are a little bit funny as well as being very serious. I think that's important to balance. And I think kids really respond to that as well, like a good dollop of humor. So that's really fun for me. My favorite thing is to put in the humor alongside like this incredible darkness and danger.
Yeah, I love that. I love that it balances out that darkness. It's one of my favorite things in middle grade. And so alongside that, and throughout the trilogy, there's a focus on Fionn's relationship with not only his sister, but also his grandfather and the island itself. And so how deliberate was this? Was this really well considered beforehand?
Yeah, probably the most well considered part of it was Fionn's relationship with his grandfather Malachy. In the earliest stages of me conceiving of the novel, the only thing that I really cared about was this boy and his grandfather, and then the island that he lives on. Those are the three elements, and everything else was built out from there. And that really is hugely inspired by my relationship with my grandfather. You know, literally Malachy looks the same as my grandfather. He speaks the same on the audiobooks. And I think what I wanted to convey was how a man like Malachy, who's going through his own like sort of memory losses, and he lives in this house of candles where he stores all of his memories and tries to keep hold of himself, how he can be going through something like that, but he's not diminished by that, and how his love and bond with Fionn isn't diminished by those memory struggles either. How their love for each other kind of transcends, you know, for want of a better word, his early Alzheimer's, or, you know, or whatever you want to call it in the book. And I thought that was a really important message to get across, maybe a little bit for myself, but also for, I think, a lot of readers and a lot of children, you know, who will have elderly grandparents who are kind of might be getting a little bit forgetful, you know, in their older age. And I thought that was the central message, was that kind of love is forever, and that, you know, it can't be so easily erased by the winds of time, you know. And that was what I really wanted to zero in on. And it was just so much fun then, once I figured that out, you know. Fionn and Malachy, they have this great banter with each other. Fionn is like afraid of everything and he doesn't want to do anything, and Malachy is sort of like this boisterous, laughing, funny sort of effervescent character who wants to take him on adventure and show him the meaning of bravery and show him what he's capable of as a boy, and kind of teach him the history of Aran Mór as it's fading from Malachy. He's imparting it, you know, to Fionn.
Yeah.
And I think writing it was really magical for me. It made me feel a lot closer to my own grandfather. It made me feel a lot better about his memory struggles, because even on the days that he can't remember himself, much like Malachy, Fionn will remember for him, you know, and the island will remember for him. And yeah, that was just a really important message, that the most important message I wanted to get across.
Yeah, I think you did that really well. And I love that about the first two books. And then, of course, the third book, it was, you know, Fionn living up to everything that Malachy right. had taught him and then really becoming, you know, part of the island, an islander, basically. So when writing fantasy or magical realism, the author needs to choose a conduit or a method for the magic. And in the Stormkeeper books, the magic is in the candles for the Stormkeepers. What made you choose candles?
So it's kind of a funny story. About 5 years ago, I was living in Dublin. I had moved to Dublin to live with like four of my best friends in this sort of ramshackle house in the city. And I was having the best time, but I found it was really difficult to write because I suppose I got into my head that I grew up right beside the sea. And in Dublin, it was so busy and noisy and I was so far from the sea that I felt like I couldn't kind of get in touch with my own creativity. And it was really bothering me.
Mm.
So I would tell my mother this like on our weekly phone calls that I was really struggling. And, you know, she was like, oh gosh, we have to do something about that. You know, I was like secretly hoping she'd buy me a penthouse by the sea, but she said, no, I have like this, I have an idea, like, just don't worry about it. I'll come up and see you next week. And she sort of arrived at my door with this tiny package. She was so excited about it. And I unwrapped it and it was like, it was a candle, but it was like a tourist candle. I'll actually show it to you. I know it's not visual, but I'll just, so basically, and the candle was called the Irish Wild Atlantic Way. And there was like pictures of like rugged Ireland on it. Mm-hmm. And she handed it to me and she was so excited. And I was like, what is this? And she was like, it smells like the sea.
Oh.
And I was like, no, it does. Like, it's a candle. She's like, no, it smells like the sea. You just have to light it. And then it will like transport you, you know, kind of emotionally or whatever. Yeah. So she went off on her merry way later on. And I was very skeptical. But anyways, sat down on my laptop and I was like, I'll just light this candle. And I swear she was right. Like this little candle that probably cost like 8 or 9 euro, she probably picked it up in a tourist, you know, shop, really did fill my room with the scent of like Galway Bay and the Atlantic Ocean.
Wow.
And it's incredible what that did for me. It just kind of transported me to a point of like peace and creativity. And I found that it was much easier for me to write burning this candle. And I thought, you know, smell is so important to people, you know, for example, like the smell of freshly cut grass in July will forever remind me of Harry Potter. Every summer when that used to come out, that used to be the smell in the air. And just my brain all these years later will link it with that first day of cracking open the new Harry Potter and reading it sort of from 7 a.m. to 11 p.m. that night. Mm-hmm. And so I kind of became obsessed with this idea that candles and scented candles can hold memories inside them. And that became the vehicle. I was already toying with this idea of this island that always remembers. So how does it remember and how do you access these memories? And I thought candles are cool. Also, candles come in every shape and size imaginable. You know what I mean? They're like a booming sort of industry all on their own. So I was like, I'm going to fill Malachy Boyle's house with 10,000 candles that are all totally different looking. And each of them will contain like their own memory that you can access when you burn it. And that became quite naturally, I think the vehicle that worked really well. Although I remember when I was sending it out to my agent, I thought it was really bizarre. I thought people are going to think the candle thing is so weird. And it was the thing globally to this day that people love the most. So yeah. It was cool, yeah. Kind of realizing that everyone thought it was cool. It wasn't just me.
Oh, I loved it. And you were saying before, I think before we started recording, that the books were coming out every summer over there. Mm-hmm. And so for me, they're coming out in winter, or in this case in autumn,
right? Yeah.
And so, you know, I'm reading this book and, you know, I've been to Ireland, you know, I'm from the UK, so it really transported me back, and the candles just added this sense of coziness, you know. So curling up with Stormkeeper in my lounge room, you know, with the, you know, just that really just added, what do they call this, the Danish word is hygge, I think it is. It just really added to that sense of hygge. There's, you know, there's this Irish coastline and candles, just I loved it.
Oh, I'm glad.
So why is it important, do you think, for today's kids to read mythology stories?
I think, to be honest, almost every story in its own way is grounded in mythology and legend, you know, from different cultures. I think that they were really our first stories, you know, all these years ago, and they're important. I think that they're kind of the OG you know, big stories of magic and battles and bravery and stuff like that. And I think there's a way of, if you're interested in middle or mythology, you know, as an author, I think there's a way to make that mythology your own and bring it into a new and modern setting so that it feels accessible for children. But much in the same way that I think children gravitate to, or maybe adults gravitate towards sharing classic children's stories from their childhood with their children, you know,
yeah.
Or like why someone like Roald Dahl is still so popular, is because some stories are timeless, and I feel the most timeless stories of all really are myth and legend. And for me, like as an Irish author, I always try and put like my own cultural stamp on everything I write, because I'm so proud of where I come from, and I think it's rife with really interesting history and magic and myth, and it's a natural decision or a natural kind of path for me to take, is to just kind of pinch little bits of my own culture and history and weave it into a new and modern tale to make that palatable and accessible to children of this age. And I think I don't think everyone has to do it, obviously.
Yeah.
But I think those authors who are really interested in mythology can, there's just so many ways that you can take it for your own and repurpose it and make it something special.
Yeah. And I think that's something that Australia struggles with, because in terms of white people, our mythology is Irish and you know, British mm. mythology. But in terms of the land's mythology, it's been denied for so long.
Right.
And it's just starting to come mm-hmm. out. It's just starting to be incorporated into the mainstream. And, you know, we need to be very careful how we do that. But it's really nice to see that coming in and to start having our own identity.
Yeah.
So it is interesting to think about that, you know, in terms of here in Australia. Yeah. So the story involves quite a bit of time travel of sorts, and the third book circles back to the first two very, very well. How much planning was involved in the time threads?
Yeah, you know, it's so funny, when I started writing it, in the very first draft of the first book, I didn't have any idea. It's really, you have to be so careful when you're memory hopping, really, because it makes it in a way a time travel trilogy, and then once you start time traveling, you have to be so careful because you end up in this elaborate web. So the answer is, the first draft of book one, I didn't give it much thought at all, and then by the time I was doing the second draft, I realized I need to be so careful, I need to know what beats I'm going to hit in each book. So the way that I planned it is, I gave Malachy Boyle 7 special candles. So in his house, maybe it's 5. Like, is it 5 or 7? I think it's 7. 1, 2. Let's just say 7. But anyways, in his house of candles, he has a special shelf in his bedroom. And Fionn doesn't know why. He just knows that these candles or these memories are obviously really special and really transformative for whatever reason. And those memories for me became the big events in each book that would change the course of Fionn's destiny or the island's destiny. And when he accessed those candles, real tangible changes would happen in the modern current world that he was living in. Mm-hmm. And so I put a lot of thought into these memories specifically from day one, or day two more like, and how they were going to change the story. So once I knew it was going to be in those candles, and I worked that out really soon, then I knew what I had to be careful. It's hard to answer this question without spoiling like all the twists. Yeah. Then I knew all the things that I had to plant along the way to make some really good twists along the way, but then some really explosive sort of reveals in the last book.
Yeah.
But yeah, I had to be really careful and like really meticulous with everything from line edits to copy edits. You know, it's like a really, it's a group effort, because
you
might miss something. It's really easy to miss something, but you have to be really careful. But I think I did that well. But yeah, it was a tall order. It was actually quite tricky to make sure it worked out the way it did.
Yeah, there was a point where I was, you know, when's he going to burn the next candle? Please burn the next candle. And then, you know, which memory is that going to go back to? I think they had one where he was back in this, and a memory he'd been in before, and asking on, you know.
Yeah. That actually was really tricky. Yeah, the one that he can go. Yes, there was all these like layers and levels. And there was one of the candles I actually didn't put anything in. I left a 7th candle, and I was like, okay, if I need this candle come book 2 or book 3, I'll give it something. And that candle was called Blood Moon.
Mm-hmm.
This like red candle that, yeah. You know, is this mysterious red candle. And I think it ends up being the very last candle that Fionn burns.
Yeah.
And it does something quite spectacular. But that particular plot didn't come into being until book three. So I saved that candle because I knew I'd need to put something in it. So
right. And so that was going to be my next question, was had you planned the plot from the beginning, from book one? But obviously no.
Everything but that candle. But I just knew I'd have a loose end. And I thought, well, instead of wedging something in at the last minute, I'll plant it in book one and I'll make it work by the time book three comes around. So it feels more natural.
Clever.
Perhaps kind of risky, but because the candles are all kind of predominantly weather based.
Yeah.
So I was like, I'll just make a blood moon and then whatever needs to happen under that blood moon, I'll come around to it. So that was perhaps a bit risky, but I think I pulled it off.
Oh, you did. That's amazing. Because it just seemed so well planned to me as a, you know, because I'm always looking at it as a writer as well.
Right.
Wow, yeah. Why did you plan this? You know, all these things that go back to the first book and the second book. And yeah. So just in terms of all this, you know, making sure all the threads worked and editing, what sort of help did you get taking the initial draft or the final of your drafts to then the publishable state?
So it was interesting. I sold the first draft. I did a partial. So I wrote about 20,000 words, maybe even less than that. And so it was basically just Fionn arriving on the island, him going to this magical cottage, meeting his grandfather, and then I think burning one or two candles and figuring out the candles contained memories. Like that was as far as I got. It was really kind of rough, and it sold to Bloomsbury on that partial alone. And so it was a really, I've never been in that position before where I was working with an editor from the outset. And what happened was I wrote the first draft and she said to me, do you want it to be bigger than what it is? And what it was at that stage was a boy and his grandfather in a house full of magical candles, and there was no bigger framework or no higher stakes than that.
Yeah.
And she said, I think this could be really epic if you build it out a bit more, and we could do a quart. At that point it was going to be a quartet, and I really liked that idea. She kind of was really great at pushing me to really reach my full potential. We work really well together, and so I went back and I redrafted it, but because she's such a good editor and she kind of knows what I'm capable of, on a second and third draft every book went through about four or five drafts, you know, like full extensive. Well, I think the last book went through about five really extensive edits. So and that can be really tricky. You're down in the trenches like with your editor, and you're, you know, you're trying to get the best out of it, and you're talking through all these philosophical things about, and who should go in this memory and who needs to have their big emotional moment here and who isn't, you know. We got so deep into it, deeper than I think I would usually get into a book. But I think that was really important for this story for me, because it's so personally important. And also because there's, like you said, there's so many there's this big web of time and stuff. So I think I was really lucky to have a really hands-on editor who was so committed to making it kind of the best that it could possibly be, that we put so much work into it together. And I definitely think it's not a place I could have gotten to by myself. You know, I think a lot of the time with authors, their editors are the unsung heroes, but I'm always singing her praises because she's a really fabulous editor, and it was very much a team effort, you know, getting it to the finish line.
Yeah, how amazing to have someone to bounce things off like that.
But then conversely, you're always like, when you're expecting the first edit letter, you're like, no, because you know it's going to be like, rewrite for all of this, or like, rewrite everything, which is, it's always demoralizing that first hour when that email comes in, but always for the best in the long run.
Yeah. And what's your process for when you get these edits? I'm assuming that the time frames are pretty short, so do you take yourself off somewhere and just focus for the whole day? Or
yeah, my process is like the first hour I just sink into a deep depression over the amount of work, and then I'm usually, yeah, what I'll do is I'll read through, I'll have a chat with my editor, we'll talk it through. And then I'll go for like a walk by the sea, and I'll have to think about it, and then I'll come back, and then I'll literally just do a chapter outline and put in all the things that need changing, or maybe in this five chapters have to go and five new chapters come in. I try rework the timeline. So I like to work chronologically. Mm-hmm. I just can't work any other way than chronologically. So then I literally just go through it like chapter by chapter and throw things out and put things in as I go and try and kind of make a new, stronger draft. It usually takes about 4 or 5 weeks on the first edit. And then every edit after that is shorter and shorter and shorter.
Yeah. So the first two books were released prior to the pandemic, and I'm assuming that this book was delayed because of it. How has the pandemic affected you as a writer?
I think the truth is not poorly. As a writer, not as bad as I thought it would be. Mm-hmm. Because the books were so successful, say prior to the pandemic, and by that I mean they were translated into over 20 languages, I was doing a huge amount of travel, and to the US. I was due to go to the Sydney Literature Festival right about, I think, a month or two after the pandemic hit, and that was cancelled, and I was so disappointed. But I was kind of going on all these little trips to Europe and back, and that was really fun. But in the promotion of the trilogy, I found I had didn't have a lot of time to sit down with my own thoughts and write. I liked, when I'm writing a first draft, I really like to have like a week or two full weeks of nothing. So I feel that I don't the mental space to get into it. And I didn't have that as much. So when the pandemic hit and it was like, you're not leaving your house, you can't go outside of 5 kilometers, and you've nothing to do but sit with your own thoughts. You know, for me, it was helpful. It was really helpful because I just had to sit down and sort of write. And in a way, because of how bleak everything was in the real world, for me, writing middle grade escapism was fantastic, because you're just jumping into this magical world where everything is more exciting and, I guess, more imaginative than what's going on in the real world. So I found it to be a great source of escapism for me, professionally. That's probably the one, silver lining that I could find, that I've just had to sit with myself. Basically.
Yeah. I know it was hard for a lot of writers to be creative because
that's the other thing. It's when the world is like closing in on you and it's dark and depressing and every update is terrible. I can see how people would be paralyzed, they can't do anything. They can't the writer's block isn't, I'm lucky. I think for me, it didn't go that way, but I know so many people that did happen to, there's you just can't tell until it happens. And then you're like in the storm of.
Yeah, exactly. Well, we had two lockdowns. The second one was more harsh than the first here in Melbourne. And the first one, I actually wrote a novel that had been sort of jumping around in my head for a while. And then the second one, I didn't do anything. And then we had a third very short lockdown earlier this year, and it had been so long since I'd written that novel and done a few edits, and I sort of went, I've got 5 days to jump in and do another round of edits.
That's good. Yeah, interesting.
Yeah,
I think the first lockdown was a bit like almost like not like a novelty, but remember way back like a year ago, and everyone was like, ooh, like definitely over here it was like, ooh, lockdown, everyone watched Tiger King and whatever it was, like a 3 or 4 week thing. It almost felt like, it wasn't fun, but it was like, it was novel.
Yeah.
And I think by the time, we're all in our second and the way, it's getting worse and worse and worse. I think, then you're in a different headspace because you don't see a way out as quick.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And I know you're just coming out of it now. We're not too bad here in Melbourne, but you'll get there soon.
I hope. Oh gosh, I'm afraid to hope.
Yeah, I know. We felt like that 5 months ago. So what is one thing that you hope that children will take away from this trilogy?
Can I just say two things?
Yeah, sure.
I can't decide. The two things, the first thing I think, well, I would hope the children would take away is the importance of older people in our lives, be they grandparents or grandparent figures, and how important their stories are and how interesting they are, and how I think how wonderful it is to really take the time and sit with your grandparents and talk to them about their lives and learn you know, all these things that you might not know about them. I think by the time I figured that out, I was a bit late to the party, and my granddad was sort of, you know, starting to lose his memories and stuff. And suddenly they became really important to me because I felt like I was part of him and part of his story too. I wish I had figured that out when I was a bit younger and really kind of sat with him more and badgered him for his stories. And the second thing is how important being outside in nature is, like how good it is, I think, for your mental health, and how fun and exciting it can be to just go outside your house and just get into the weather, go for walks, go down to the sea, go to the hills, go to the mountains, wherever you live. I think nature is so healing, and that's something that I really have discovered in the last probably only 5 or 6 years. I was a real inside kid when I was younger, and I kind of think I wish I'd done a little bit more outdoor exploring, basically, especially in this day and age with like iPhones and tablets and all that kind of stuff. I know it's more difficult, but I would say the power of nature is quite something.
I think both of those things are things that, as you know, even though we want them children to realize that, it comes with maturity as well.
Yeah, which is it's like the catch 22.
Yeah,
because you kind of realize like when you're like older, you're like, oh, I wish I'd appreciated those things more. It's really hard, to tell that to like a child, and they're just going to be like,
I don't care.
Don't
worry, I've got two boys. And I do a lot of I've been doing a lot of genealogy research, particularly for my husband's side of the family, because it's really interesting, because their great 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 grandfather is buried right down the road from us, and he was he came over to Australia from Prussia 100 years ago, or over 100 years ago. So yeah, it's really interesting. But you know, so I was kind of looking into my family side, but I mean to my husband's family side, but my family side is just as interesting. And my grandmother, she died a few years ago, and I have lots of her stories, but she never told them when she was alive. She never told them to us. So that's, you know, one of the things is, like you said, you wish you'd badgered your grandfather, but maybe somebody should have badgered my grandmother more while she was alive, you know, to tell
us. It's funny that you say that these stories exist and they're really interesting, and they don't, it's the same with me. Everything really fascinating that I learned about him didn't come from him. It's maybe there's a thing of like they don't like to talk about them. I don't know. It's interesting. I feel that it is a bit of a shame, because you would have loved to heard it from the horse's mouth, but at the same time, it's great that you can access that history. And it's that you could discover that that your kids have this great 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 grandfather who's just down the road. That kind of stuff is cool. I always feel like it's it feels kind of magical when you hit on something like that.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, this is something I could talk to you about much much more, but so the Stormkeeper books are available all around Australia, in store and online, and as you said, in many different languages. Where can our listeners find you online if they want to find out more?
I'm on Twitter at Doylecat, and I'm on Instagram, and I have a website called katherinedoylebooks.com where you can email me if you have any questions.
Fantastic. Well, it's been an absolute delight talking to you today. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. It's been wonderful.
At about the age of 8, Belinda Morell began writing stirring tales of adventure, mystery, and magic in hand-illustrated exercise books. As an adult, she combined two of her great loves, writing and traveling the world, and worked as a travel writer, journalist, and public relations consultant. Now inspired by her three children, Belinda is an award-winning, internationally published children's author with a history of writing in her family that spans over 200 years. For younger readers, Belinda has her popular Lulu Bell and Pippa's Island series. Her latest book is The Golden Tower, a time-slip fantasy set in a magical Italian Renaissance-inspired world. So hi, Belinda, and welcome to Middle Grade Mavens.
Hi, Julie. How are you?
Oh, we are doing good tonight. So we're recording at night, which is unusual for us. So it's great to have you on the Mavens.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. It's great to be here.
Now, I know that writing is clearly in your blood from your bio, but will you tell us how you actually got started in writing for children?
Oh, writing is definitely in my blood. There's been so many writers in my family. In fact, my sister, Kate Forsyth, and my brother, Nick Humphrey, are also award-winning internationally published authors. So I think we all started writing when we were little kids, and we've been writing ever since, writing together, writing alone. So yes, I started writing when I was about 8, and very much inspired by my favourite authors when I was a child. I used to write them in hand-illustrated books, and I just kept writing all through school and all through university. And once I finished uni, I started working as a writer. So I've worked as a writer ever since I left uni at the age of 20. And I worked as a journalist and did all these different kinds of things. But all the time I was doing that writing, I had this dream that maybe one day I'd be able to write a book and get it published and have it read by people all around the world, maybe, if I was lucky. So, but I didn't really do anything about it until I had my own 3 children, and I started writing stories for them when they were little, because they were just like I was as a kid, voracious readers, loved their reading. I shared all their books with them, and sometimes I'd read books with them and think, oh, I wish I'd written that. It is so fantastic. And other times I'd read a book with them and I'd think, oh gosh, honestly, I'm sure I could write something better than that. Yes. And so I started writing stories for my kids. And I wrote a novel called The Quest for the Sun Gem for my 3 kids. I have 2 boys and a girl, and I filled it with all the things they loved about books. So they loved fantasy adventure. They loved a dangerous quest. They loved bows and arrows and sword fights and epic battles. And so really it was for my children. And then when I finished it, I read it to them and I read it with them. And then I felt like I'd be very, very brave, and I'd send it off to Random House. And I was absolutely thrilled when I heard back from them a few weeks later. And they said, Belinda, we love it. You know, is this part of a series? You know, where are the other books? When can you get them to us? And so I signed a 3-book deal with Random House a few weeks later. And that was the start of my writing career. And I've been writing with Random House full time ever since.
Oh, which is Belinda,
a dream come true.
Living amazing. The dream. I mean,
absolutely.
Let's just go back to the fact that they answered you within a few weeks.
Yes, I know.
That's unheard of now.
Yes.
But oh, wonderful.
Yeah, no, it was just great. And I think it was because I was writing for this tiny little audience of 3 children.
Yes.
And not worrying about a wider audience. And I think just bringing all the magical things that I knew my kids loved, and writing it with that passion for them that helped me hit the mark with that first book, I think, which was a great start.
Yeah. Oh, I want to go and read that book now.
Well, it's amazing because The Quest for the Sun Gem came out in 2006. And it is still selling, and I still get letters from kids saying how much they love it. Oh. And every single time I do a book visit or a school visit, suddenly there's this flurry of kids wanting to read it again. And so it's great.
Wow, that's so great. Oh, I might have to acquire that for the library.
Yeah.
No. And as I reviewed an episode 83, but The Golden Tower, for our listeners, is a fantastic book that mixes middle grade magical realism with the Italian Renaissance era. Now, where was the inspiration for this book?
Well, partly I've been getting these letters from kids for years saying, Belinda, could you please write some more fantasy? Because I'd written time slip historical novels, I'd written junior fiction, I'd written sort of contemporary realism, and there was this constant, steady stream of letters saying, Belinda, please, could you write another Quest for the Sun Gem, another Sun Sword trilogy? And so I was playing with the idea of doing this, of writing a more fantastical book. And then I was on holidays with my family in Italy, and we're wandering the beautiful streets of Rome, and we're looking at all those beautiful buildings and eating all that beautiful Italian food. And we're wandering in Trastevere, and we see a little street sign, and it's Vicolo de Mazzamarelli. And I turned to my kids and I said, oh, this alleyway is named after our family, the Morelli family.
Yes.
Morelli
family.
And we all had a little chuckle at that. And then I thought, well, I wonder why it's called Vicolo de Mazzamarelli. What's Mazzamarelli? So, of course, being a writer, being curious, I started doing some research, and I discovered that Mazzamarelli are these amazing mischievous pranksters, little fairy people, a bit like leprechauns or brownies. They're Italian, and they make noises at night, and they play practical jokes on people. They tweak people's noses, they steal things, you know, one odd sock and, you know, keys and all yes. those sorts of things. And I was fascinated by this, and apparently there was a palazzo on this spot where the alleyway was, and this palazzo had been haunted by this tribe of Mazzamarelli prankster fairy folk. And I thought, oh, I have to write a book with these Mazzamarelli in them. So that was the very first idea. And then I started researching Italian folklore, fairy tales, mythology, and I started gathering all these ideas over. That was 4 years ago when that first happened. And then I planned a trip back to Italy with my family to go back and really research the settings, research the history, yeah. the culture, the art, the food that I could then weave into my story. So, yes, it was very much fun to go back and just have absorbed myself in this Italian Renaissance culture and history. It was just wonderful.
Oh, wow. Which is kind of my third question. But was it sort of like you walking around with a notepad, you know, just taking notes all the time, and the family going, come on, Mum, we're tired, we want to go eat, you know?
Yes, there was a little bit of that. So they were thrilled when I said, okay, I'm writing a book, we're going to go back to Italy. They were so excited, and my kids helped me plan the trip. And I had this idea about I loved Italian fairy tales, and they're very different to the ones we know. So, for example, Rapunzel, which we know, is very different to the original Italian fairy tale, which is called Petronella. So in Petronella, the girl is locked up in a tower, but she's really clever and she's brave and she's bold, and she uses her wits and her cleverness to get herself free. She's not sort of sitting there waiting for Charming Prince to ride by and get her out of there. And I loved this idea. So I thought, oh, our towers. And of course, Tuscany is filled with towers. Every little hill town is bristling with towers. And so we went and we stayed in Lucca in a medieval tower. And, you know, there's nothing like, you can read about these things, but it's nothing like actually doing it or staying there or seeing it with your own eyes to really bring that to life. And my kids were beside themselves. So they helped me choose the tower we were going to stay in. And it really was medieval. There were peeling frescoes, and the walls were, you know, a meter thick, and the little, you had to climb to the top. We were right at the top. And, you know, by the time we got to the top, you know, we were so fit after staying there for a week.
Oh, I bet.
Right at the top, there was this beautiful loggia that looked over Lucca and the surrounding valleys. And then later on, we went and stayed in a castello in the countryside out in the hills outside Florence. And it was an 11th century castello with this tower, this golden tower. And we stayed there as well. And this tower had this resident couple of cats that used to come, and no matter how we closed the door, somehow they always managed to get inside our tower to visit us and, you know, say hello. And I sort of came up with this idea of the cats being a really important part of the whole Italian culture. And so there was all these little things that you do when you can see it with your own eyes, and you're living it, and you're eating the food and listening to the music and just wandering the back streets and the alleyways. It brings it all to life. But I do remember we were in Florence, and we'd been visiting a few of the art galleries, the Uffizi and various places. And then I said, okay, guys, now we're going to see the Palazzo d'Avanzati, which is a Renaissance palace in Florence, which is furnished and exactly as it was back in the 15th century. And my boys looked at me and they went, we might meet you later, Mum. And my daughter said, that's okay, Mum, I'll come with you. Yes, they did get, they weren't with me every step of the way, but they did really enjoy the journey.
Oh, I would have loved to have been one of your children. I have been to Italy, so I know the magic of Italy. It's incredible.
Oh, it is so gorgeous. And it was just so interesting. And I was just really inspired, particularly by Renaissance women. And there were some really bold and amazing women. And so I drew on the history of a lot of these women when I was creating my characters. So they're not accurately, truly historical characters, but I really have drawn on real women from the Renaissance to get my inspiration for my characters, especially in Ginevra. So Caterina Sforza and Isabella d'Este. And of course, the Medici family of Florence was a really big inspiration as well for some of my characters, particularly Isabella and Bea. And I think lots of research.
I think I did read that in the I always read the author, you know, notes at the end, because that always feels like but that, you know, they've just told their story and then they tell the story of how they made the story, and it's always fascinating. So
it is fascinating. Yeah. I always read that too, in fact. Yeah. I find that one of the, I think you get a real sense of the process behind it by reading those notes. No, I love it.
Now, editing a book like this is something that I think would be quite unique, because it's a, you know, it's a time slip, but it's also, you know, so ingrained in, you know, the Renaissance era. Editing is something every author endures. Can you give us your take on, like, how you do it? Do you embrace it? And do you perhaps have some tips for a new author about to embark on the journey?
Oh, absolutely. Yes, editing is tough, but writing a book is really tough and hard work. But I find by the time you get to the editing stage, you're really, really bringing the story to life, and you're really taking it from a pedestrian level to something much more amazing, I hope. So I feel like the first draft of my book is always pretty terrible, and I feel like it's a skeleton that you're just setting up the bones of the story, and then in later drafts you're adding layers and layers and layers of detail and description and action and tension. And so to me, the editing is absolutely the most important part of writing the book. So I go through, I spend a long time editing it myself before I submit it to my publishers, and hoping to take it from something that is probably very pedestrian to something that I hope is sparkling and shining. And then the real work begins, because I start working with my publisher, Zoe Walton, and with my editor, Mary Verney, and we go back and forward over many, many months, and we do it again and again and again. And I find that process is so interesting, and I just have implicit faith in my publisher and my editor to tell me when I've missed a beat, or I don't know, I do really strange things, like in every book there's a word that I use endlessly, and they'll point it out to me that, you know, I've used this particular word 972 times, that perhaps I'd like to rephrase some of them, or they tell me where I think in my mind it's very clear what's going on, but I might have just kind of, it might be a little bit confusing for a younger reader, or whatever it might be. I trust them implicitly, and that would be my biggest tip to an author starting out. Is I can remember in my first edit there was a couple of things that I was thinking, oh, but I love that image, or I love that word, or I love that, no, I think I really love that really long description. And the thing that I have learned is that to trust my publisher's recommendations, and to implicitly, like 99% of the changes they recommend, I just, yes, of course, yes, of course. Unless there's something I disagree with, and then we try and negotiate away. Occasionally I'll get a bit stubborn about something, but we try and work a way to make it, explain it better perhaps, or make sure it's an integral part of the story. Yeah, so absolutely, I think editing is what takes an ordinary book and makes it hopefully just sparkling and fabulous and brilliant. And it takes months. I would say that it would take me as long to edit the book as it takes me to write the first sort of solid draft. So
I have this saying, I don't know, I think I made it up myself, I probably just copied, but it's just be not enamored by your own words. Like be willing to leave many of them behind.
Well, I think also the important thing to remember is that when you're writing, is you're writing for your reader. It's a gift for your reader. Mm. So you have to not think about, it's not about me. It's not about your writing. It's about this gift to the reader, and you have to make it as exciting and enthralling and engaging as possible. And that's where the editing, I think, is so important.
Yep. Definitely. And covers are something that I'm really passionate about, and I do judge a book by its cover. This one was gorgeous, and I think it was by Federica Frenner.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yes, thank you. She did a gorgeous job.
And is it still magical seeing that cover for the first time, no matter how many books you've had?
It's just so amazing. I always get so excited to see the cover of a new book, and I love being part of the process of designing the cover. So I go back and forth with my publisher, and she suggests what she's thinking, and we talk about ideas for it, and then she'll show me, what do you think, I found this And what I loved about this was that she went to Italy to find an Italian illustrator to give that really authentic Italian flavour to it, which I thought, isn't that wonderful?
Yes.
And so I looked at her work and I said, absolutely, I think that's a great idea. And then she did some pencil sketches and roughs and I went, yes, I love that. That's beautiful. And the only change I made to her cover was originally the original design didn't have the little Mazzamarelli peeking over the corner there. And so I said, is there any way we can get a Mazzamarelli somewhere in the cover? And I love the way she's just got this little head kind of peeking over out of the frame. It's really, really cute.
Yeah. And I've asked that question of so many authors and their answer has been, actually I had nothing to do with it. So I love the fact that they're so, inclusive of you and your ideas.
I feel very lucky and I think it's really interesting. I remember I generally am really thrilled with the covers, but I do remember there was one cover on the Forgotten Pearl it wasn't the Forgotten Pearl, it was the Lost Sapphire, and I wasn't really happy with the colors and the emotion and the mood that she'd created, and I spent about a whole day with this email just crafting all the reasons why. I mean, I love your work, of course, but
yes.
So they actually changed the whole cover to incorporate my feelings on the subject, which I thought I was so lucky to have that interaction, that ability to give the feedback and for that to be. So yes, I love the covers and I can't illustrate myself, so I just so admire seeing the way the designers do such a beautiful job and the illustrator work together to make it look so gorgeous. So, yes, I absolutely love the cover. And so many people have commented on how beautiful it is.
It's very catchy. Glory there. Yeah, you've hit the jackpot on that one. And I know that you are very active in schools. Have you ever had an aha moment, perhaps when a reader has connected so wonderfully with your books and in turn changed their life and perhaps changed yours as well?
Absolutely. It's so amazing and so humbling when it happens. It can be as simple as going into the school playground and having this little group of kids come running over to me going, Belinda, she's here. How exciting. Oh, I love your books. You're my favorite author. Whatever it might be, as simple as that. I had a little girl who just sobbed and sobbed and sobbed. She couldn't stop crying because it was the best day of her life to meet her favorite author. And I was in tears too because she was so overwrought. And I've met parents that have just come up to me and said, Belinda, we just want to tell you that your book has changed our lives because our child, our son wouldn't read. He refused to read. He was stubbornly not reading, and reading your book switched him on to read, and now he's an avid book lover. And many years later, I had one mother saying, goodness knows how we could have got through the HSC if it wasn't for you, because you got him onto reading when he was 11. And that's lovely. And I love seeing kids out there in the world reading my books when they don't know who I am, and I can just see them sort of holding my book or reading it. That's so much fun. But I think the thing I love the most is getting letters from readers, and I get hundreds and hundreds of letters, and some of them are just simple, thank you, I loved your book, and or I love this character or that character. But the ones that are really amazing, I've had a few from older readers who loved my work when they were perhaps 11 or 12, and now they're about 18 or 19 or doing their HSC, and they write to me and tell me what a huge impact my books had on their life as they were growing up and becoming children to becoming adolescents and teenagers and adults. And one girl wrote to me and she just said, all the values that I hold dear, I learnt from reading your time slip books. And she said, you are my favourite author and I've read all of your books, 17 times or 20 times, and they had such a huge impact on me. And now I'm an adult and I can see that the adult I have become is all because of you. And I bawled my eyes out when I read that letter, and I sent it to my publisher and she cried too. And we just went, aren't we so lucky to be doing something that is, that has such a huge impact on readers and on kids and can help them learn about the world and their place in it and help them think about what they want to be and who they want to be, and really, really influence their lives, which is such a privilege and such an honor, but also has a lot of responsibility with it.
Yes. And putting your heart on the page, really, it brings hearts to your page, doesn't it?
Yes.
Yeah. Yep. Yes, big responsibility. But one that you are, you know, able to fulfill, because that's who you are.
Well, I really do love getting that, having that interaction with readers. And some of them write to me for years and years and years, and or send me birthday messages or Christmas messages. Yep. It's really special. In fact, my daughter had an amazing experience on the weekend. She did her final, she's just finished uni, and she did her final job as a waitress at a wedding where she's been working. And then it turned out that by some coincidence, they discovered her name was Emily Morrell, and the bride had loved my books. And Em said it was so funny. She was holed up. She's meant to be working at this wedding, but the bride's talking to her, "I can't believe you're Belinda Morrell's daughter." And about her favorite book, The Locket of Dreams, and then I've actually mentioned it in the wedding speeches that that the wedding was blessed because they discovered that Lauren's favorite author's daughter was working at the wedding, and you're just going, what a small world.
You never ever expected to be mentioned at a wedding, but yep.
And how could they have grown up so much to be getting married, my readers?
Oh, no. Oh, yes. So let's go to what is one thing, or perhaps 10, you wish your newbie author self would have been told by an author like yourself. That is, one who has stood the test of time, as you've just said, and kept producing books that children love.
Oh, that is such a tough question. And I've thought about this a lot, because when I started out, I was so naive, and I knew very little about the publishing industry, and I learned it all, you know, along the way. Yeah. But I was also incredibly lucky, because I find that the children's book industry, authors are so lovely, and they're so supportive, and they're so generous with their knowledge and their time and their gifts of knowledge. So I was lucky to be mentored by a few different authors as I started out. One was John Flanagan of Ranger's Apprentice fame, and he was just so kind to me and gave me all these gems of advice. Another one was Garth Nix, and I remember him, you know, telling me ideas like, just keep writing, the best thing you can do is just write the next book, just keep writing. And I had a lovely conversation with Marcus Zusak at the Sydney Writers Festival before my first book came out. I'd signed the contract, but it hadn't come out, and I was so anxious and nervous, and so overwhelmed and overawed by these incredible writers I was meeting. And he said, "Oh, Belinda, congratulations, and when that first book comes out, it'll be one of the greatest days of your life." And he said, "But one thing I'd like to share with you is just remember to celebrate your achievements as they happen. And just remember to keep the joy in your writing and in your career, because what will happen is that you'll be so excited your first book's published, and then you'll see some of your friends are being shortlisted for awards, and you want to be shortlisted for awards too. And then some of your friends will start winning awards, and you want to be winning awards too. And then they'll get, you know, amazing overseas publication deals, and you want to be published overseas, and then you want to be translated, and then you want, and everything, every time you get to the top of that mountain, you can see there's lots and lots and lots of mountains beyond that. So you have to celebrate each achievement as you get there, and not be, you know, forgetting it, looking to the next thing constantly. And Marcus said that was one of the things that he found himself doing, and that he had to consciously stop and just celebrate each achievement as being an amazing thing that has happened. And so I think that's one of the things I try to remind myself of now, is just to occasionally my sister and I will have a glass of champagne and celebrate something, and we go, well, we this may not come through, this may not turn into a multi-billion-dollar movie deal, but let's just celebrate this particular moment and this particular achievement, and make the most of it, and not be wasting away the the joy in what you're doing, and remembering to write with joy as well.
Yeah. Oh, that's lovely advice. So we've just had a pretty rough year and a half, I guess, during the pandemic. I mean, it's not ending, but there were so many books that came out that I know didn't get the shine that they deserved. Has there perhaps been a middle grade book on your shelf which you felt could have had a bit more love and you'd like to share with us?
I think, there were so many books that came. I had two books that came out last year, and it was so strange not being able to celebrate in the usual way with launches and all the other things that you do. It was so.
Tell us about your books then.
I had a little junior fiction book that came out at the beginning of the year, just before the pandemic hit. So we had this big, we had all these launches and events and things planned, a big party at the State Library and all these wonderful things. And of course, in a week, you know, all these festivals, I was meant to be at the Abbotsley Festival and all these things. And in a week, it all fell down like a house of cards, and which was quite shocking at the time. And also a lot of, you know, like just, that's where a lot of the money comes from, is doing school visits and events and things like that. So it was, goodness me, like what a disaster. But so that came out just in February, at the beginning of the year, just before COVID really hit. And then in November, towards the end of the year, I had a book called Searching for Charlotte, which I've written with my sister Kate, which is an adult nonfiction, a combination of a biography and a memoir that we wrote about our great-great-great-great-grandmother, Charlotte Atkinson. Charlotte Waring Atkinson, and she was the first Australian children's author, wrote the first Australian children's book, published in 1841, and she was also the mother of Australia's first female journalist and Australia's first female novelist, as well as being a pioneer feminist for women's rights in Australia. So she was an extraordinary woman. And so Kate and I spent, nearly 3 years writing and researching a book about her life. So that came out, and we couldn't even have a launch party for it, and we had a literary dinner planned in Canberra, and they pulled the plug on it literally 5 days out because there'd been another wave of you know what. So that was my experience with COVID launches. So it was a lot nicer this year when The Golden Tower came out. I actually was able to go into a number of schools, and we were able to have some book events, bookstore events, and signings and things like that, which was, you know, which was a relief. But in terms of other people's work, there were so many amazing books that came out. And I have so many friends who are authors, amazing authors like Jacqueline Harvey, Oliver Pomervan, Rachel Spratt, Deborah Bella, Tim Harris. They all had books coming out, and we all had the same problem. But one of the books that I read last year that I absolutely loved was We Are Wolves by Katrina Nannestad, set during the Second World War. And I thought that was an extraordinary book, and I really, really loved reading that. I also, what else did I love? One of the other books that I feel that I loved a lot was actually by my sister Kate Forsyth, which was a collection of fairy tales. So she had Snow White and Rose Red and other tales of kind young women. And one of the reasons I particularly love this book is it. One of the fairy tales she explored was Snow White and Rose Red. And when we were growing up, lots of people said, "Oh, you're just like Snow White and Rose Red," because I'm a blonde sister and Kate's a dark sister.
Yes.
And we have quite different personalities as well. So I did love that book. And what was the other one I was going to say? Oh, yes, The Fire Star by A.L. Tate. A fantasy adventure book. And so I'm really thrilled for Alison. That book's doing really well and getting some fabulous reviews. And so it's, you know, I think it's great to see so many wonderful middle grade books coming out and being celebrated and enjoyed by kids and teachers and librarians and parents. So, and it's so nice that so many of them are my friends.
Yes. We have, I think, reviewed, I think, nearly all of the books you've mentioned. And it was just so, we were desperately trying to read as fast as we could during the pandemic so we could review as many as possible. So
that was the only good thing about the lockdown and COVID, was actually I had so much more time to read, and I just loved that freedom to actually read books. And I was sharing books with my kids and with my family, and we would, you know, read a book and pass it on and talk about it. And so it was a really one of the joys of last year was actually having much more time to read than normal, which I embraced fully. It was great.
Yep. So what is next in the wings for Belinda Morell? And I hope you say that there's going to be another Renaissance time slip.
That's the plan, or that's the hope. So, in very exciting news, I've just signed a contract with Ulverscroft in the UK, and that is to do an audiobook for Searching for Charlotte, and also for The Golden Tower, and as well as publishing books over there, which is so exciting.
Yes.
And I have been working on a synopsis of a sequel to The Golden Tower, and I've pitched it to my publisher and she loves it. So I think that's probably going to be the next plan, but I don't know the details yet, as in deadlines and when that might be coming out. But other than just kind of working out a rough plan, I haven't started really working on that yet. And I've also pitched an idea to them for a new junior series of children's books. So we just sort of have to work out, you know, what comes first and what we focus on. So I'm having a little break, which is really lovely. So I've just finished a publicity tour for The Golden Tower, and I've got about a week or so to get my life back in order before I start writing the next.
Oh dear.
Exactly. So, you know, cleaned out the fridge, cleaned out the pantry, you know, did the mountains of washing.
Mopped the floor for the first time in a year. Yeah.
And my kids have been enjoying it because I've been having a bit more time to do some lovely cooking for them. So they're pretty excited by that. It was my daughter's birthday last week, and I said, okay, an Italian feast. And they said, yes, please. So I cooked a beautiful Italian, not quite Renaissance inspired, but a good Italian family feed. And they all loved that.
Wonderful. Oh, I want to come for an Italian feast at the Morell House.
I love experimenting, and the kids get to taste it. So I'll be going, I'm thinking about this, and we're going to be cooking this in the book. And yes, that's a good idea, Mum. Yes, love that.
Wonderful. Well, what a delight it has been to have you on the Mavens, Belinda. Where can we find you if our listeners are wanting to check out your books?
Well, of course, they can go to my website. So it's www.belindamorell, or one word, .com.au. And they can also find me on Instagram, which is Belinda_Morell. And there's a Facebook page too, which I keep regularly updating. And then there's lots of interviews and videos and things that they can find on the web. So my web page also has links to my video page and my Instagram and my Facebook. So that's probably a good place to start.
Wonderful. Well, thanks again, Belinda. And I am looking forward to Renaissance Time Slip Book 2.
Oh,
remember the Mavens.
Of course. Thank you so much, Julie. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for stopping by Middle Grade Mavens. If you'd like to know more about the Mavens, log on to middlegradepodcast.com, or to find Julie online, stop by julieandgrassobooks.com. And to find Pamela, stop by www.uckerman.net.